This episode of Uncommon Deeds is brought to you by Barry Tile and Morrison Clark, Central Vermont's stop for all types of flooring for your home or business on the South Barry Road in Barry, Vermont. 802-476-0912, celebrating 50 years in business. Bushy's Generator Sales and Service, Vermont's number one dealer for Briggs & Stratton generators. Two locations in Springfield and Brookfield, 802-591-1903 or bushysgenerator.com. We keep your power on. And VT Fire, protect yourself on and off the racetrack with a state-of-the-art fire suppression system serving racers and commercial, industrial, and residential needs in Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York. Call 802-793-7919 or visit VT Fire on Facebook. I'm Justin St. Louis.
And I'm Tom Corbett. This is Uncommon Deeds.
I got to roll.
Welcome back, everybody. Another episode of Uncommon Deeds. We had a Crunch Bunch episode this week, and it was a good one.
And I think I've only ever met Troy Kingsbury like once or twice, maybe twice. And now I wish that I'd raced with him the whole time that he was around. What a cool guy.
He has COVID chickens.
COVID chickens. Amazing.
But no, for everyone tuning in to our show, thank you for tuning into our show. But go back and give Al's Crunch Bunch podcast a listen.
The obituary file is just the greatest invention I've ever heard of. And I don't want to give any more away than that. But Jesus, what a show.
But we're back with a show for you today as well. I mean, it's today, whenever you listen to this.
Yeah, they're all days.
A bit of a hectic week for us, as is custom. It seems like more often than not. But really, though, it's the first time in a while where we've had kind of a true turn and burn. Yeah. So,
well, we had scheduled an extra day in there, but things happened. Tim LaDuke, our guest this week, is self-employed, and I hadn't heard from him all day on Tuesday, and I was like, you still good for tonight or what? And at 10 minutes to 8, he's like, yeah, I'm still at work. I was like, okay. So this is a Wednesday night, late night edition. Not quite Austin Terrio hours, but close.
Creeping on it. But yeah. We also had we haven't had a technical difficulty in a while either. And we had in getting the Zoom connection with Tim locked in. So we lost about 45 minutes there. And we're doing open and close right now. It's about 10:30 on Wednesday night.
Yeah. So this is
and we got to record a new commercial when we're done open and close and a new quick open. So I'll have all that to edit tomorrow. But with a new commercial, Justin, means a new sponsor.
Yeah, VT Fire. Pretty excited to have Hunter Garduno on board with us, another racer. And he's got a pretty cool little program going that he started up earlier this year. And he installs fire suppression systems in race cars. And that's not all he does. He's got the nozzles that are above gas pumps, like when you go to the gas station, the fire suppression systems there, you know, that kind of stuff, or in a kitchen at a restaurant, or if you've got something, you know, similar at your home. Really cool, really essential stuff. So racers, you know, get a hold of them, because not only is it an important part of your race car, but he knows what he's doing around a race car. That's kind of the most important piece of that whole thing.
Absolutely. And you can get more information on that midway through today's show.
Yeah. Just listen to that commercial. We'll tell you.
We will. T-shirts, hats, still available. We got some still left. All you got to do, hit us up on any of the socials, Uncommon Deeds on Twitter and Facebook, Uncommon Deeds Podcast on the Instagram. I usually don't
say it now, or do I have to wait until the end of the show?
I don't know. We'll wait.
The Instagram.
Yeah, we'll wait. There's a link. But no, talk to us on any of those. Let us know what you're looking for. size-wise, style-wise, in terms of hats, $25 for a shirt, $35 for a hat, $50 if you want to get one of each, and that includes shipping. There's no hidden tax. There's no shipping costs. That's us sending it to your door.
And we'll give you a decal, too.
That is true.
For free. For free.
Absolutely free.
Mm-hmm. Good show this week.
It is. It's a good show, and it's late, so we're going to get right to the show.
Tom.
Without further ado, Justin, make today's introduction.
We talk a lot about racing dynasty families on this show, and this guy is absolutely part of one of Vermont's great racing families, and the roots date back to the 60s, but they are very much alive and well as two members of the family. One on opening night at Devil's Bowl last Saturday. He's the defending track champion, and he actually won a championship before most of his competitors were born at Devil's Bowl too. So not to make him sound like an old guy, but he is certainly a veteran and a well-established one. Tim LeDuc, welcome to Uncommon Deeds.
Thank you for having me.
What a disaster getting you into this show, but man, it's looking good now. I think we're ready to go.
Yeah, let's hope.
So we usually kick it off the same way every week, and that's asking you when you remember motorsports coming into your life.
Oh, boy. Well, I was brought to Devil's Bowl for the first time. I was roughly 3 months old. Because back then when, you know, my parents were dairy farmers and my dad always raced. So, you know, they, you know, obviously never had, you know, money to, you know, provide babysitters back then. So we always got dragged along to the races. So, I mean, I went to Devil's Bowl at a very, very young age. And, you know, I've been at Devil's Bowl since, you know, pretty much I was like 3 months old. As far as remembering when I first was there, you know, that's, I really can't tell you that, but it was a very young age.
So you were born in 73, right? If my numbers are right. So that would be asphalt. So you are an asphalt racer at heart.
No. I mean, I did race the asphalt a little bit, and I do run Friday nights over at Claremont, New Hampshire on the pavement. And, It's a lot of fun running a little short track at Claremont with the dirt modifieds. You can still move around a little bit compared to a lot of the bigger tracks where you just, you know, basically follow the leader. So you still can move around on the small track.
Yeah. What do you remember about your dad racing back then when you were little? And I know that he raced as you were growing up, but what do you remember about old reliable Charlie LeDuc racing back then?
Well, like I said, my dad passed away in 85. You know, so when my dad passed away, it was very unexpected. I do remember going out into the garage and, you know, sitting in a race car and stuff like that and going to the racetrack. And, you know, it's kind of weird. Actually, one of my favorite drivers back then, you know, I mean, obviously it was my dad, but was Wes Moody was always one of my favorite drivers back in the day was Wes Moody. You know, my parents actually, you know, went to Wes Moody's place quite a few times. And, you know, he was always kind of the one that I liked to watch, you know, growing up. But obviously it was obviously my dad, you know, I mean, I can remember me and my sister used to go to Airborne, sit in the back of the old farm truck, you know, to, you know, wooden side racks, you know, and back then you could ride in the back of vehicles, you know, but I really don't remember too awfully much about the racing back then. You know, I know that he, you know, we didn't have much money, you know, to, you know, back then to be able to afford to do too much. And, you know, so my father pretty much, you know, being a dairy farmer, didn't have a lot of money. So the only money that he ever had for the race car is that he, worked for the town of Orwell plowing snow, and that money that he got in between milking cows was what he had for the whole race car. He never really had much for sponsors or anything.
CJ Richards was the promoter at Devil's Bowl, and he called your father Old Reliable.
Yes.
Where does that nickname stem from?
Well, my father started racing in 1963 at the Fairmont Speedway, and He pretty much never missed a race. No matter what, he was always there every week. And he, you know, he won a few races. There's no question about that. But I mean, as far as he was always there and, you know, he always, he never missed a race regardless. One way or another, he was always there and was able to pull through the gate, you know, regardless. And he never missed a race. And it was, you know, just like my mom here, she just passed away a year ago last week. She missed one race at Devil's Bowl since the opening of Devil's Bowl. You know, so I mean, our family has always been there, and that's where, you know, as far as being named O'Reliable, that's where that came from, is that he never missed a race. And, you know, so he was, he didn't have much to work with, but he was always there.
When he passed away, did that draw you in more to racing because that's what he loved to do? Or did you almost want to get away with it, get away from it a little bit?
I think that, you know, I mean, you know, one regret that I do have is, you know, I was only 11, but my mom, she sold everything, and still to this date, I'm trying to find his last car. And, you know, if anybody is ever watching this and they ever knew where that car actually went, I would love to know about it. But when I went and turned 15, after my dad passed, I used to help Jimmy Ryan on his car. And then Carl Murray, I used to help him out. And, you know, just being around it, I wanted to do it myself. And when I turned 15, I started building my first Mustang. And then you had to have a driver's license to race. You know, so I started when I was 16, you know, obviously Devil's Bowl in Albany, Saratoga.
There's been several other members of your family that have raced, you know, like I said, was there anybody racing at that time?
No. I had an uncle, Philip LeDuc. He raced back in the 70s. But other than that, I mean, as far as any other, and I had one uncle, Elroy LeDuc, back in the 60s, he only raced for one race. He came out of turn four and endowed it, and that ended his racing career. He never, I don't think he ever turned a lap. And, you know, we always just call him One Lap Elroy. But other than that, it was just him. And then my Uncle Phil raced for quite a few years. And then obviously my father raced, you know, full time.
Did any of them kind of reach out and help you when you were ready to try it at 16?
Actually, no. You know, it was, you know, like I said, I lost my dad when I was, you know, only like 11. But anyways, long story short, I pretty much learned 90% of this stuff on my house. Myself, I did have quite a bit when I went and got into, when I first built my GT there, my little four cylinder. Carl Murray helped me out quite a bit when I first got into that, as far as, you know, learning how to build the motor and et cetera, et cetera. But pretty much a lot of it was just, you know, hanging around, you know, the racetrack all the time and, you know, doing a visual on everything on how to do things, you know, and that's pretty much how I've learned growing up as far as, you know, my whole racing career.
Were you kind of a hands-on kid around the farm? I mean, were you building stuff and cutting it up? And that's kind of been a common theme with this show.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, growing up, you know, beside our farm, we have a hill that goes down the field. And I can remember from, I mean, we got pictures of me. I don't think I was 5 years old sitting out in the driveway. And my father had an old box of welding rod that probably had been, well, you know, wet 30 times. And here I am gobbing stuff together. And we used to make go-karts and, you know, go down the hill and hit a ramp and endo them and come drag them back up and weld them back together. And, you know, so, I mean, we've always, you know, been innovated as far as that's concerned. Yes.
Did you build your first Mustang on your own, or did somebody brace it up for you, or
how? No, I built the whole thing myself. I actually, it's kind of funny. I mean, it was like a tank, but I went and built it all out of black iron pipe. I mean, my neighbor, Lewis Hart, he had a steel place, and that's where I got all the iron from. And I bent everything myself. I actually borrowed a pipe bender. I think at the time I don't think it was Vince Quinville's. I think it was John Daniels at Champlain Construction. And I bent up my first roll cage and everything all myself and welded it all together with our old stick welder and, you know, fabricated the whole thing myself.
It's pretty intense for a kid who's 15 or 16 years old.
Well, like I said, I can remember growing up in out in the driveway sitting there welding. And, you know, at nighttime, it felt like somebody threw a handful of sand in your eyes, you know, because you didn't need helmets back then. You know, it's yes.
Well, you needed them back then. You just didn't have to have them back then.
That's why I have to have glasses now, because yeah. I can't see.
So, you know, those first couple of years in that GT class, when there were a ton of cars and it was fun racing and it was what, you know, it was pure racing, what it was supposed to be. But you were kind of one of the big dogs right out of the gate, weren't you?
Yes. Actually, it was my third race out. I ended up winning. And that was at Albany, Saratoga. Actually, my first race ever out, I think I ended up getting third. But like I said, I had a lot of support. As you know, my mom supported me 5,000%. You know, she was my mom and my dad. I can remember my mother coming out, you know, sitting in the car, bleeding, you know, trying to bleed the brakes for me. And, you know, so, I mean, Carl Murray helped me out a lot as far as the motor and stuff, as far as what to do, you know, what cam to run and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it was a lot of good memories. And I, you know, I wish that little class was still around, because I mean, it was a heck of a good class, as if you, you know, as you know, you used to run them.
Yeah. I think that's kind of coming back with the way that the four cylinder divisions have been going lately. It's more stock and, you know, cars aren't $50 anymore, but you can get into it relatively cheap and have some fun.
Sure. Definitely. Yeah. Yep.
So with early success, do you start thinking about progressions, or were you just trying to have fun?
Well, obviously when you first started out, it was just start to have fun. You know, and then obviously, you know, the racing bug gets you, and then, you know, you always want to go bigger, bigger, bigger. So it worked out at that. I stayed 3 years in the little four cylinder class. And then I moved up into what they call the late. We used to have what they call the late models. My first car was bought from Matt Sear out of Milton, you know, Gene Paul's brother. I ran in that class for 3 years and then went into the Sportsman Modifieds. I raced them for 4 years and then I've been in the Modifieds, you know, what they call, you know, the 358 Modifieds until they switched to the crates down. You know, the crate division, obviously that's what I'm in now.
The late model class in the early to mid 90s on the CBRA tracks was, I mean, those were race cars. Yes. And you had some wicked drivers too, like Eddie Keenan.
Yes.
I don't know a lot about that era. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like? I mean, was it 1,000 cars or was it a short field or, you know,
It was when I first got into it there, there was quite a few cars. I would say we probably averaged right around 20 cars. And then towards the end of the late model era, when they went and switched to where you could run completely tubular frame cars, Burt transmission, quick changes, that's actually when I had moved up. And I think they were down to like 4 or 5 cars. There wasn't that many, but, you know, back in that day, you know, like you had mentioned, there was, you know, Fast Eddie Keenan. You had David Holbrook, Jim Ryan, Carl Murray.
Wild Warren.
Wild Warren Pease. You know, Ernie Greenier. There was, you know, a lot of them from around here. You know, just trying to, you know, Gardner Stone and Todd were in that class. You know, it was a really fun class back in the day. Randy Etson used to race it, which he's, you know, it's kind of weird that it seems like as generations have gone here, everybody went and left that division. And now you haven't seen any of these guys in 20 plus years. Now all of a sudden they're all coming back, getting back into racing. And it's kind of weird how, you know, the evolution has changed. Another guy, Mike Palmer, he used to race in that class, was very good in that class back in the day. Was.
The Sportsman division back then, those were 358s, right? Those were, you know, full-blown race cars as well.
Yeah, they were a complete full-blown 358 car. there was zero difference, you know, just like there is now with the crate divisions. Back then, the 358s, sportsman cars and modifieds were the same identical cars, same motors. You know, when you jumped into that class, you know, you had some snot underneath the hood. It was, but it was still very intimidating when you went to move up. And we see that down here now. I mean, the difference between a sportsman car, I mean, you know, your sportsman and a limited sportsman is obviously your, how do I want to say it, is your,
that's your experience level.
Your experience, definitely, you know, and, you know, when I can remember when I ran the sportsman, the last year I was in the sportsman, I mean, it was incredible. I won just about every race there was. And, you know, you go into the modifieds thinking that, hey, I'm big and cocky. And it was a wake up call in a hurry, you know. But I was very fortunate when I did move up into the modifieds. My first year, I won the championship at Devil's Bowl and I was runner up at Albany Saratoga. So, I mean, it did not take me long to adjust moving from the sportsman, but, you know, that era is a lot different than what the era is now, as far as, you know, crate motors. You don't have the power to move around like you know, you could get yourself out of predicaments with horsepower.
What was it about Albany Saratoga that made you want to kind of branch out in that direction?
Well, it was, like I said, back in, you know, I raced Albany Saratoga for 22 years straight. Every Friday night, raced Albany Saratoga and obviously Devil's Bowl. And then we went and did a little bit of travel and I raced what they used, well, which is now Mohawk, which is Frogtown. I had been there. I'd been to Cornwall, Ontario. We went and kind of went all, you know, over the place back, you know, 20 years ago, you know, when a lot younger and fuel prices and you could afford to do a lot of that. And it just seemed like life was not quite as hectic as it is now. But Albany, Saratoga, you know, when they switched to pavement is when I went and, you know, pretty much stopped running Albany, Saratoga. And I have run Albany, Saratoga a couple times and, you know, since then, and we probably will be going back there a little bit this year. We have another brand new car that it's all complete. We're just waiting for the motor and we're probably going to branch out and do a little bit of traveling with the new car.
You know, the CVRA circuit, which was Albany, Saratoga and Devil's Bowl, and for a while Airborne, but not in the era that you were racing. Albany, Saratoga and Devil's Bowl were the same officials and the same rules and the same everything, but it was two very different shows, right? I mean,
that's correct.
And it's still sort of that way that it's an all-star race every Friday night at Albany, Saratoga.
And I don't really understand that. I mean, you know, it was fun to race there, but it's, you know, it's the same thing it is now. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. Devil's Bowl has definitely taken off tremendously in the past few years. But Albany, Saratoga, you would always go there and every single night the place was jam packed. I really don't know what there is about Albany, Saratoga that, you know, draws everybody there to the place. You know, I've raced a lot of racetracks and still to this day, you know, my favorite racetrack is Devil's Bowl, you know, hands down. It's just, you know, where I'm just the most comfortablest with. And, you know, it's, you know, obviously being home track to 12 miles from home, that helps. But Albany Saratoga was fun to run and I will run it again. But it's like you said, it's just, I don't really know even what to say about, you know, Malta. It's just, a place where everybody thinks that they have to go and race. And I really don't know what that is. What's so great about it, you know?
You know, like you said, the sportsman division in the 90s was exactly the 358s. And it is exactly the same model as it is now, basically, that it's all the divisions are the same other than the experience level. So you didn't have to refamiliarize yourself when you moved up with anything other than the competition level. So what is it like racing against, you know, the sportsman level, the entry level, I guess, modified division at the time. And then you're the champion and listen, you won 8 out of the last 10 shows at Devil's Bowl in 99. It wasn't even close. But then you jump into the Hornet's Nest and you're racing with Kenny Tremont, and I don't know who exactly was there at the time, but I'll throw out names like, you know, Brett Hearn and Mike Perotti, and I'm sure Jack Johnson was there, you know, a bunch. Yes. And, you know, guys like that every week, Bob Savoy and guys like that. And you win the championship as a rookie at Devil's Bowl, and those guys raced at Devil's Bowl too. It seems like there wasn't any transition period for you.
It kind of looked that way, but there was. I mean, at that time, you know, I'll throw out a few other names. I mean, at the time, you know, Dave Camara. Dave Camara was my biggest rival.
Good God.
Back then, you know, and obviously Vince. You know, actually, Dave Camara helped me out tremendously when I went into the modifieds, moved from the sportsman to the modifieds. Because at that point in time, we were both avid TO. We both had TOs, and Dave helped me a lot when I was in the sportsman. And then when I get in the modifieds, you know, I moved a lot of that information along with me, of course, but, it was definitely a transition. It was no different than, like, I've explained to a lot of the younger people now that have moved, like Troy Ida. I was speaking to him the other night, and, you know, this was pretty much his first race, and he came in, he's like, oh my God, you know, and, it's, you know, like I explained to him, when you're running sportsmen, you can be a lot more relaxed. If you leave a little bit of an opening, nobody's going to be there. When you move in with the modifieds, if you leave a half an inch, there's going to be a car parked there, you know. So you really got to, you know, up your game as far as your driving style. You know, you constantly got to be up on the wheel versus in the sportsman. What I found is that you could be a lot more relaxed. And I still think it, you know, is that way today, even with people moving, you know, moving up in divisions.
Kind of building off that, in that transition, does it change your mentality at all? I mean, maybe for some of our listeners who are more like Thunder Road people, we've seen people go from dominating a Tiger sportsman, then they get in a late model and they're far more tentative. Does it take, you know, a switch to be flipped? Or were you able to just kind of same mentality?
It was, you know, pretty much the same mentality. I mean, like I said, I was very, very fortunate, you know, when I moved up from the sportsman into the modifieds, that I, you know, as far as I was very dominant the last year in the sportsman class. And, you know, when I moved into the modifieds, it was, you know, I carried that momentum with me at the time. And everything just all clicked together. You know, I mean, it was, you know, me, I'm very anal when it comes to car preparation and everything like that. And I think a lot of that still to this day prolongs as far as, you know, finishing races and making sure that your stuff is, you know, on top. And if you don't stay on top of your maintenance program, that's huge. And, you know, I think that if you keep all your stuff maintained, it's definitely going to show in the outcome as far as your performance.
Do you get more confidence off knowing the work and the details that you followed building up to the race than your racing ability itself?
Good question. One thing I do pride myself on is, as the way I do go through my cars every week, when I do go onto the racetrack, I know my car is, every nut and bolt has been checked. I know that it's set up to best of my ability. And I know when I go to the racetrack, you know, I have just as good a chance of anyone else, you know, to go out and win a race and be competitive. You know, it's just like an insurance program, you know, when you take and you go out there and you know that, you know, this has been checked, that's been checked, every nut and bolt is checked, and you're not going out there and saying, oh my God, I hope this doesn't fall off or break or anything like that. You know, I've been, you know, like I was not to be redundant, I've always been very, very thorough on how my cars are prepped.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of the running joke is that it's chrome everything on your car.
I've always taken a very lot of pride in my car, and so many people have said to me over the year, well, it's only a race car. Well, it's, you know, that's why at the end of the year my car still looks the way it does at the beginning of the year, you know, as I take very good pride. It's not the fact that I always change everything, is I just take a lot of pride in making my car look the best that it can And because if you just beat your car right to heck, before you know it, you got a pile of junk, and it's, you know, you gotta have a good piece if you want to be able to try to be competitive.
Did your dad race that way? Was this a mentality that you learned, or did it come naturally to you?
That's what's kind of weird is, like I said, I mean, back in the day, my dad, you know, there wasn't much money, and, you know, he always made do with what he had to make do with, you know, I mean, he would take and build absolutely anything and everything for the car. And, you know, obviously the way that the world has gone, now you don't build anything for these cars, you know, it's pick up the phone and, you know, you get the part sent to you. But my father was always very, even though he didn't have much, his cars were always a very clean looking car, never, you know, it was a very clean looking car, and took pride in what he had.
When you moved into that modified class, were you starstruck at all?
I would say yes. Starstruck. I probably had a lot of cockiness in me because of that. You know, it opened up a lot of people's eyes, I think. Not trying to toot my own horn, you know, I had a lot of success my first year in the modifieds, and I had a lot of people watching me. Could I probably have gone farther with my career? Probably. But, you know, the funds just aren't there, you know, in our location, you know, here in Orwell, there isn't a lot of big sponsors or anything like that, that can really, you know, progress you to be, you know, nobody's going to come out and give you, you know, back then that kind of money to get a big block or be able to do a tour series. You know, I pretty much, you know, I worked, breathed, and slept racing. That's all I did, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You drove some races for Spot Shaw in the early 2000s, right?
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, we actually went and Spot got to the point where he really didn't want to race much. Well, actually, I take that back. We had an open show at Albany Saratoga, and we went and put a wing on Spot's car, and he let me drive it. And went and actually finished second to Dave Camara. You know, we had a little small block racing against the big block, and we almost beat him with it. And the following year, Spot's like, well, why don't you drive my car one night a week? So it worked out. I drove Spot's car one night. You know, it'd either be at Malta or Devil's Bowl and vice versa. And I drive my car one night a week. And we did that for about a year. And then it just got to the point where it was too much trying to, you know, keep, you know, his car going, my car going, and be on top of things. And, you know, that's when we kind of, I mean, parted ways, I guess you could say, and went back to doing our own thing.
I was going to say, you mentioned earlier that you're, you know, anal about the details. I can imagine trying to have two cars ready every week would be a lot for you to handle.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was. And, you know, it was even more, it's kind of funny, me and Vince Quinville were just talking about this the other day. It's like back in the 90s and 2000s, you know, we were racing 3-4 nights a week. You know, we'd race Albany Saratoga on Friday night, get home at 3-4 in the morning, and then we'd go to either Frogtown or Granby, Quebec on Saturday night, and then Sunday night back to Devil's Bowl. And it's like, you know, we're like saying now, how the heck did we ever do that? You know, when you have enough trouble now making it one night a week, you know, and that's, it was definitely different back then.
Do you think that crazy period made you a better racer? I mean, seat time is everything. So you get 3 years worth of seat time in one season. That doesn't hurt things, right?
It is huge. And like I actually was talking to you the other day, it's like, you know, last year was, I raced pavement last year on Friday nights over at Claremont, and obviously Devil's Bowl every night on Sunday nights. And I honestly can tell you, I think that helped me tremendously as far as racing pavement and dirt at the same time, because you got to be a lot smoother. And now with the way the tracks are hard, slick. And I think that definitely made a huge improvement as far as my program last year. And we're doing the same thing this year.
Before we get into the, you know, the current era of things, you know, and again, Devil's Bowl was and Malta were pretty awesome in the CVRA years.
Yes.
In those 358s, the 2000s were excellent. Is there a night that stands out in your brain that, you know, feel like you're on the top of the mountain kind of thing?
I think the first, top of the mountain was definitely, as I still remember, you know, like it was yesterday, my first modified win ever was at Devil's Bowl. And I actually beat Bob Savoy, and he was leading the race, and there was like 2-3 laps left. And I just kept working him on the outside, And we came across the line. Actually, both of us were bouncing off the wall, and I beat him by, you know, just a matter of inches. And, you know, it was pretty incredible, you know, after the race for somebody that had been around that long and come over and, you know, congratulate you and say, you're going to go far, kid, you know. And I'll never forget them words that he went and said that to me, you know. And that's the one that sticks out the most, I believe, out of all of them.
That's pretty awesome.
Does that make you want to pay it forward to the young kids now who come up to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Lisa sits there and starts telling me now that I need to start charging for some of this, but I honestly do. I take a lot of pride, I think, now. A lot of the younger kids, the younger generation that's down there coming up and asking me for advice, you know, it kind of puts me in the shoes of like Bob Savoy and Dave Camara at the time. And even Carl Murray and them guys teaching me, you know. And it's kind of a great feeling. It's like right now, it's like, you know, down here at Devil's Bowl, I get, you know, Cody O'Brien comes up, talks to me, AJ Munger, you know, and I raced against his, AJ's father, Gene, for years. And it just, it's pretty awesome to have them kids come up, you know, that watched you, you know, watch myself race growing up, and now they're coming to me and asking me for advice or suggestions, you know. And it's a really, really good feeling. And I take a lot of pride in it. You know, I mean, I will always help any kid in the world down there that comes up and asks for it, you know. Definitely.
Have you had that moment where you realize that you are the gray beard, you're the veteran, and you're not the kid anymore, you know, starting at 16. Well, I know I picked on you about it at the banquet, but you know, your first championship in 2000, when you got into the 358s, Justin Combs, who you beat for the title last year, was 8 years old at the time. Yeah. And I think it was like four of the drivers who ran full time with you last year hadn't been born yet. So, right. I mean, there's gotta be a moment where you look around and you're like, these friggin' kids are still in diapers and I'm over here going bald. Like, where, you know, has that moment happened for you, or was it just gradual?
Gradual. And, you know, now it's like, you really stop and, you know, think about it. It's like down at Devil's Bowl now. I mean, you know, there's only a few of us that are actually left. I mean, that, you know, part of the original gang, as far as the 358, you know, you got myself, Vince, Jimmy Ryan, and that's pretty much it. You really don't have too many of the originals left anymore. And I do look, you know, think about that here we are, you know, getting older, and all these, you know, younger squirts are coming in and, you know, handing our butt to us many nights out of the week, you know. And that's, but you know, like I said, you hit it right on the head. Seat time is huge. And, that's where we picked up the pace last year with, you know, getting back more seat time, and seat time is everything. Just jumping in the car one night a week is, you're not going to stay on top of your game.
Usually when you get to that point, it goes one of two ways. Either maybe you start seeing the finish line get closer and closer, or you get a little hungry and you get a little more motivated. And it sounds like it's more the latter for you.
I'm not going to lie to you. Before last year, the previous year, I was fortunate enough. We went and had a brand new car, and I could not make heads or tails of that damn thing. And, I actually did get to a point where I'm, you know, like saying to myself, I'm done. It's got to be me. No matter what we did, it just, nothing would work. And it starts to get into your heads thinking that, you know, hey, this is my time. It's time for me to hang the helmet up, you know. And then obviously last year when we went and switched car manufacturers, and it was like an instant light switch. So many people came up to me and says, wow, we haven't seen that Tim LaDuke in the past couple of years, you know? So, I mean, it's, you know, I don't want to end this racing career being one of them where it's, you know, I'm not competitive anymore is what I'm saying. You know, and as long as I can continue being competitive, I'm going to continue my journey.
Here's a fun one that I've always wondered, and you know, race fans are funny sometimes, and they have their favorites and they have the ones that they don't like, and you get more boos at Devil's Bowl than anybody else, it seems. Why is that? When did that start?
That actually started back in the sportsman class when in sportsman, we went and back then sportsman cars, even though they were the same cars, the caliber of car was not the same. And I was very fortunate to have brand new chassis that, you know, 1 year there where I, you know, basically every time I went out, I won with it. And that's when I first got into TO cars. And, you know, obviously people did not like that. Just like anything, they don't like to see the same person winning every week, stinking the show up. And that's when it really started. And yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It's back in that day, it was, you know, you were a lot younger. And I shouldn't say you didn't respect other people. It's you did what you had to do to get to the front and to get there quick and, you know, pull off wins. And, you know, it's a lot different now. You look at things a lot differently. You know, it's back then, you know, you were, you know, I was, you know, like I said, when you lived, breathed, slept racing, you know, if you caved in a quarter panel or caved in body panels just to get that win or get up through the traffic, it never bothered you. Now it's like, you know, it's like, I don't want to work on the car all week, you know, pounding panels. I want to make the car, you know, better. You know, you have a totally different mindset now than what you used to have. But definitely was back when it started in the sportsman era. And then when I jumped into the modifieds right off the get-go and started winning races, a lot of people, I think it was the fact that you take a, you know, back then a 20-year-old kid was considered a kid, and you're going out, you know, racing against guys that have raced for 30, you know, 30 plus years and beating them. And now I'm on the other shoe, you know, I got, you know, here I am just shy of 50, and you got kids that are out there that are, you know, 12 years old winning races now. You know, I kind of see where other people would kind of see that, you know.
Did you enjoy being, you know, the villain, quote unquote?
I think yes. The villain, yes. It's, you know, as Justin can tell you, I mean, me and Vince Quinville were, you know, comparing apples to oranges growing up. You know, I mean, we used to beat the hell out of one another just to get to the front. And, you know, and now it's funny. I mean, Vince and I are, you know, good friends. We talk all the time, and now we actually respect one another. You know, back then it wasn't the fact that we didn't respect one another. Vince and I were about the same caliber. We were very, very aggressive, and we went to the front, you know, and, but in doing that, it, you know, I would say definitely upset a lot of people. You know, and now, you know, you look at things completely different.
How much of that was just the fans? Because of course you put your mothers together in the grandstands and in the front row of the grandstands every week for 30 years. And, you know, sisters start jowling at each other, and then the group gets bigger and bigger. I mean, you still get booed by the Quinville fans, even if you guys haven't raced each other side by side in 3 years or whatever. You know, like, are they just holding on to old feelings? Or
you know, it's like I've always told people, What the worst thing that I've always hated about the whole racing thing, I shouldn't say being in the spotlight, but I guess you could be in the spotlight, is people judge you as a race car driver. They don't judge you as a human being. And that's one thing that always was very hard for me to accept. I'm the type of person, I don't like people mad at me. I don't like people upset at me, you know, and that always bothered me, but I had to grow a thick skin. It's just like you said, you know, you can't control fans and you can't control family members. And, as you know, you hit it right on the head. You got the Quinville family, you got the Leduc family there. And that generation goes back, you know, 30, 40 years, you know, back when people used to, our mothers used to sit there and get in fights with pocketbooks, you know, and in the grandstand, you know, it's
the Barb and Barb show.
Barb and Barb show. Yep. And Butch Jelly's wife and all of them, I guess it used to be back. I don't obviously remember it, but I guess it used to be quite comical back in the day.
It's almost amazing. Like those European soccer games where you just got to put one section over here and they cheer over here, and then the other section over there and they cheer over there, and never the two shall meet.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So 2010, the CVRA tracks are paved. What was that like for you? I mean, I would imagine it's pretty devastating.
It was definitely devastating. I can't tell you how many runner-ups to the championship, and then starting that whole new era. I went into it with a positive attitude. I had a TO car built for asphalt, went into it. And when you've never raced asphalt before, it's completely different on dirt. You know, you make a little bit of a mistake, you can make it up immediately in the next corner. Asphalt, you make a little mistake, you know, you're talking tenths of seconds. And I think that was very, very frustrating for me. I did win a couple, once or twice on the asphalt at the bowl, but it was, be perfectly honest with you, it just put me in the mindset that I literally had to force myself to go into the garage to work on the race car, because it just took everything away from me. You know, all the years of racing on dirt and then going to do something like that, where it's just follow the leader. And I think a lot of it was frustration because you just couldn't pull out and blow it harder into the next corner to make it up, you know? And I think, you know, that honestly, that almost ended my racing career right there, was the asphalt at Devil's Bowl.
It kind of did end your career for a while though.
It did. It did. I took I think it was 2 years off. And something I've always wanted to do. I mean, I went and sold every bit of everything that was racing related. I got rid of everything. I kept my fire suit, and I'd always wanted to do it. I ended up getting into I built a pulling tractor, and I got into that and got hooked on that very, very bad. And then as soon as Mike went and put that little dirt track on the inside, one night Scott Duell says to me, "Why don't you come down and drive my car?" And that was like bringing, an alcoholic from an AA meeting right to a bar, you know. And it was like, that's all it took, and right back into it full bore.
So why tractor pulling? What was it that
exactly?
What was it about that drew you in?
Well, it's obviously your local fairs, Addison Field Days and all them as a kid. And growing up, everybody always went to tractor pulls, and anything with horsepower, I've always, I've always liked horsepower, building things. And it was kind of a new challenge for me. Let's put it that way. And, I went and got into that, start building my own motors, everything. And, it's quite an art to building a pulling tractor, you know, of the caliber that I have. It's not, you know, just a regular farm tractor by any means. People think a lot of people have said to me, it's got to be very boring pulling a tractor only 300 feet compared to going around in circles for 30 or 50 laps or whatever. But it's very hard to explain the adrenaline rush in that 15, 20 second run. it's just completely incredible compared to racing. I mean, don't get me wrong, racing is definitely major adrenaline, but getting behind one of them things is, it's totally incredible.
I still can't believe that you even get that thing dirty. That tractor is immaculate. How many horsepower are in that thing?
Well, from when you saw it last, at that point in time, we were, it's what we call the altered farm tractor, which they start off as like a 1066 international farm tractor. And at 125 horsepower stock, and we were roughly right around 1800 horsepower. And now I've taken it to a new level. The tractor, we actually just got it back in November. It's been down in Springfield, Tennessee, down to Ace Chassis, which they build all Grand National pulling tractors. So it's been down there, basically brought it down, was only going to do tin work to it, you know, put aluminum sheet metal on it, and pretty much end up reusing the rear end housing. You know, we went built, you know, it's full blown. Now horsepower wise, we will be upwards right around 3000 horsepower now. My with, God. And we'll be roughly probably right around 4000 foot pounds of torque with it. It's like I said, that is more just as bad of a addiction as the racing. Definitely.
And in layman's terms, and I don't need dollars and cents, you know, we're on here every week and most everybody tells us it's, you know, racing is not a cheap hobby to get into. Where does tractor pulls come on that spectrum?
Yeah.
Take racing and multiply it by 40. Tractor pulling is, if I could do now, if I could rewind it, I would have never have gotten, we always say this, never gotten to the level where I am now. Tractor pulling has definitely gotten way out of hand. You know, what used to be where you could bring a tractor out of your field, go hook to a sled, a stone bolt, and have a good time, come home and throw it back on a baler. You know, now it is just so far out of control and parts are ungodly. I mean, for what you have invested in a motor, you could have 3 to 4 brand new dirt modifieds just in a motor.
You must love it then.
Yeah. I don't know if it's love or what you want to call it. You
can't get out now.
Yeah. That's right. It's
you had a really, you know, successful run when you were doing it all the time. And you know, we had that show at Devil's Bowl a few years ago. I think it was 5 years ago at this point. And I found a stat somewhere getting ready for the show that you'd in 23 hooks, you won 19 hooks that same year.
Yes, that is correct. I've been that the tractor has been very, very successful as far as that's concerned. You know, and it's just one of them things that tractor pulling is a little bit, you know, I mean, it's a lot different than the racing aspect. The racing aspect is like, you know, we have like on the racing, you know, we pretty much know what you have for rules every year. It's, you know, GM crate motors or even the 358s or big blocks, they have a set of rules. When you get into pulling tractors, out of the whole entire motors, you only have just a few rules. The rest of it is unlimited, you know, so it's, you know, run what you brung. Hopefully you brought enough, you know, and the technology changes weekly in these pulling tractors. I mean, it's you could have something, you could have the best of the best today, and 2 months down the road, what you have is ancient. That's the worst part about the tractor pulling. It's, you know, things are always revolving nonstop with them.
So to kind of build off Tom's question, you know, when you have a good season in a sportsman car, like what you're running now on the dirt tracks, you can almost break even.
That's correct.
You know, you win some big races, win a championship, and you'll pay for the motor probably and most of your tires and fuel for the year. I can't imagine that you're making a whole lot of money at field days.
No, like all your, I mean, not going to lie to you, your average hooks around here, anywhere is in New York, you know, because when I was pulling in New York, you know, all over New York, Vermont, into New Hampshire, pulled quite a bit. Your average hook, a good hook, you're only winning $500 a hook. I mean, the pay and tractor pulling is, it's one of them things that, you know, it's just like you said, racing now, you can, I shouldn't say make money. You can pay for your fuel. You can pay all that. You know, just to start my pulling tractor with just ether, you know, we had it figured out. It was like, just to take and start the motor, it costs us roughly like $35 in ether just to start it. You know, just to even start it, you know, no matter if you're in a garage or at a pull or where you are, you know, just to take and, you know, start the damn thing, you go through, you know, 3-4 cans of ether just to take and get it started.
You must have an incredibly understanding significant other.
Yeah, you could say that. you know, I've never been married. I don't have any kids. You know, Lisa is completely incredible. She is, she's into pulling, she pulls pulling tractors too. So, she's been around, you know, farming her whole life, and she's actually pulled big tractors like my own, you know, the garden tractors, she's been into that, mini mods last year. She pulled, mini mod down at Scaticoke Fair. You know, she's just as much of a motorhead as I am, as far as, I haven't gotten her in a race car yet, but, she's definitely been around the tractor pulling world for, you know, 20, 25 years.
She announced that show at Devil's Bowl with me too. She's pretty good behind a microphone.
Yeah. Actually she announces a lot of the events now, and a lot of the, you know, like larger fairs, Greenwich, all these larger fairs have been contacting her now that she has been, she announces several fairs now, and tractor pulls. She, you know, tells stories about the pullers, you know, 'cause she's grown up with them, you know, just, you know, same thing that you have growing up, you know, being an announcer, as you get to know the people, you know, hand on hand, and, you know, she makes it fun for people.
Yeah. I learned a lot that day from her. Absolutely. Yeah. If it ain't red, leave it in the shed was, there I'll never forget that line. I was like, I turned, I was like, what the hell are you talking about? But I figured it out. It was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, did drag racing ever appeal to you, or just different?
See, that's what's always been kind of weird is, you know, it's, yeah, tractor pulling, you're hooking to a sled and you're only going 300 feet, you know, 300 to 400 feet, and that's an adrenaline rush. But I've always looked at drag racing as boring. You sit there and you go by yourself, you're going bam, down the end of the line and you're done. But tractor pulling, you really look at it, tractor pulling, you're pretty much doing almost the same thing, you know, but, you know, drag racing has never clicked into my mind for wanting to do it or anything for some reason.
One thing that every race car driver fears is fire, but you can take the right steps to protect yourself, and the first step is to call VT Fire. VT Fire is a professional fire suppression system installation company that can get you one step ahead of disaster with state-of-the-art fire safety and suppression systems. But it doesn't stop with just race cars. VT Fire can handle sales and installation of all types of suppression systems for paint booths, gas station canopies, commercial and residential kitchens, and more. Servicing all of Vermont and New Hampshire and expanding into New York. Protect yourself on and off the track with a fire suppression system from VT Fire. Call Hunter Garduno at 802-793-7919 or find VT Fire on Facebook.
New England weather is unpredictable, and when the power goes out, you'll need a backup plan. That's why you should call Bushy's Generator Sales and Service in Springfield and Brookfield, Vermont. Bushy's is your source for home standby generators, and they are the number one Briggs & Stratton dealer in the state of Vermont. From sales and installation to service and maintenance on all makes and models of generators from 10 kilowatts to 200. And if you order a home standby generator from Bushy's between now and the Milk Bowl in October, mention that you heard this ad on Uncommon Deeds and receive a $500 discount. Bushy's Generator Sales and Service covers all of Vermont and New Hampshire, as well as Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York. Give them a call at 802-591-1903 or visit their Facebook page or bushysgenerator.com. Bushy's Generator Sales and Service of Springfield and Brookfield, Vermont. We keep your power on. Barry Tile and Morrison Clark Incorporated have got you covered, literally. They're your number one stop in Central Vermont for all types of flooring, whether it's tile, carpet, hardwood, or any other type of flooring, indoor or outdoor, for your home or your business.
Barry Tile staff are qualified installers who can offer you real-world flooring experience and knowledge that you don't always find in the big chain stores. But you don't need our endorsement. They've been family-owned and operated since 1972, which means they're celebrating 50 years in business in 2022, and that stands for itself. And hey, not only are they great at what they do, they're racers too.
You got it, man. Check out Barry Tile's Facebook page to see some examples of their incredible work. You can call them the old-fashioned way, 802-476-0912, or just stop into the showroom, 889 South Barry Road in Barry, Vermont. And make sure that you tell them that the guys at Uncommon Deeds sent you.
Thanks to all our sponsors who help us bring this show to you for free every single week. Now, back to our show.
Okay, so you're pulling for a long time, and you went all in on that. But you did come back racing in 2015 when the little track was built in the infield at Devil's Bowl, and you won. I think it was your first race out with Scott Duell's car.
Yes.
But then it seemed like a few months later that maybe we might never see you again. You were sucking wind for a little while there in the winter of 15 and 16. What happened, or do you even know?
You mean as far as my health?
Yeah.
Yeah. They really did not ever really figure it out completely. I do plumbing and heating for a living, and they actually think I went and got into some black mold, and it basically started out as like a lung infection. And, you know, then I basically came down with like, it was like a common cold, and then it went and went right into my lungs, and then obviously went to the hospital, and then they went and for some unknown reason gave me some morphine to help with the pain. And when they gave me the morphine, it basically shut everything down in my body. And I was rushed to Burlington Hospital, and I was in ICU for almost 3 weeks, I think it was. And, you know, with lung issues and everything else. And, I was very fortunate that they got that straightened out and, came right back and started racing again. You know, it happened in the off season, but, it was a scary time. Definitely.
I have to ask, when that starts happening and, you know, losing your dad at a young age, does that creep in your mind during those tough times? Like, oh, my dad wasn't much older than I am.
Trust me, I think about that. You know, I'm 49 now, going to be 50 coming up. Well, it'd be in January. But that does cross my mind an awful lot. You know, I sit there and, you know, like I said, I do plumbing and heating and driving around to job sites, and something will just all of a sudden trigger your mind, and you're like, you know, my dad was still going at this age, and you know, he passed away only 2 years from where I am now. And it does definitely make you think an awful lot about, you know, him passing away at such a young age, at the age 52, you know. And it just it really makes you think. And you know, as everybody does, you take a lot for granted in life. And, you know, it's, yes, to answer your question, it's in my mind more than you would ever imagine.
And did that help inspire you when you were better to get back into racing?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's, you know, it's, I still say to this, you know, I mean, it's, the side joke was always been when I won my 54th win, because that was always my dad's number, 54. And with him passing away, when I got my 54th win, that was going to be the end of my career. And, that came last year, obviously. And, you know, there's the way things are going right now and the great people that are behind me, I don't foresee myself slowing down at all.
Yeah. You're up to 56 now. So I think it's clear that you're not stopping.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you could probably, you obviously, you know, the stats, you know, I think there's, one person that's ahead of me at doubles bowl and, the win column. And I don't know if, I would ever be able to catch him. But I'm going to try like hell.
Yeah. Kenny Tremont's got 89. So you better get up on the horse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be a tough one. But you know, as far as, you know, I take that in a lot too, is, you know, being the second all-time winningest driver at Devil's Bowl, it takes, and it kind of hits me pretty good sometimes to, you know, just try to imagine that, you know, all the great guys over the years that have raced Devil's Bowl, you know, Vince Quinville Sr., like you mentioned, you know, Bob Savoy, you know, all them guys that have, you know, was there at Devil's Bowl for so many years, and that I've passed where they've been. And even if I finish second, you know, it's just such an honor to be able to be in that category of them greats that have won at Devil's Bowl Speedway.
There's something to be said for longevity, and pretty much every name that you mentioned, really throughout this whole show, has been around for a long time, yourself included. 21 years between championships is a long time. Yes, and but you never went backwards. It seemed like your level of competitiveness always maintained. You were always one of the top three, top five guys every year. Is that just routine, or do you have to work harder and harder and harder to stay up there as you get older?
You have to work a lot harder. You know, we actually went back and started looking at it. You know, I mean, my last championship was in the year 2000, but from 2000 to 2021, I think I had, don't hold it to me, I think we counted, I had like 8 or 9 runner ups from there. You know, I mean, I, you know, it's just like Justin Combs last year losing it by 1 point. I think it was in 2010 before the asphalt got put on, I lost the championship by 1 point to Todd Stone. You know, and a year before that, it was Ray Horde. You know, so, I mean, I've always been very fortunate to be right there. You know, some years better than others, but, you know, it's, you got to stay on top of what I've learned here. And just as you know, in the past year or so, you got to stay on top of manufacturers, the ones that are figuring stuff out. You know, I mean, it's, you know, as you know, I was a TO loyalist for years, over 20 something years. And, you know, the past few years, not going to, you know, it's like we talked earlier, I was getting to the point where I'm like, you know, I was having brand new TO cars and still not coming, being consistent at all. And, you know, blaming a lot of it on myself. And then, you know, switch manufacturers. Last year, first race out, was like flicking a light switch, you know, and you got to stay on top of, you got to stay on. If you want to be in the front of the class, you got to stay on top of the technology that's out there. No different than the tractor pulling, you know, what you just can't go from year to year, you know, finish last year off. Hey, I won the championship last year, but you can't come into this year, you know, with the same car and say, okay, well, I ended the season with a championship. I'm going to come right back out and be right on top of the world again. It doesn't work that way. You gotta
hold on. You won opening night.
Well, yes, but we did do, I mean, granted, it was the same car. My new car was not done, but you know, we did make, I shouldn't say several changes. We made a few changes that, you know, manufacturers and parts, they have definitely did a lot of testing with a few other parts. And, you know, we, you know, definitely upped our game from last year. I feel right out of the box this year with just a few adjustments that we did make, you know. I was very happy with the car last year, and, you know, coming out this year, I was actually petrified, you know, to make changes on the car because it went so well last year. And as you know, I mean, people are always going to be trying to find that extra edge to get up on you. And if you just stay limbo in that same routine, you know, so they're going to creep up on you. You know, you always try to got to find that extra edge to stay ahead of them every year, no matter what it is.
Outside of technology, what's the biggest difference for you racing at 50 years old as opposed to, you know, 15, 16 years old? What's the biggest difference in a weekly trip to the racetrack?
What you used to find would take you 10 minutes to do on the car, now it takes you about 2 hours. It's just that, you know, as you know, we still have the same amount of hours per day. It's, you know, I own my own business, have a couple employees. And as everybody knows, when you own a business, it's very stressful. You always got to make sure that you've got plenty of work lined up for your employees, you know, so they can feed their families. And it just seems like that time goes by a lot quicker. And before you know it, the week is gone. You know, but it's, you know, that's the biggest thing. It's, you know, I keep bringing his name up, Vince Quinville. Him and I were talking the other day. It's like, you know, how the heck did we used to do it 3-4 nights a week? And now, you know, what used to take you a night to do now takes me, you know, 2 nights to do, you know. And it's, you know, as you get older, you start slowing down, and, you know, maybe it's being more thorough and not such a, you know, in such a rush to do things. I mean, yeah, you can still get it done, but I think I just, you know, kick back a little bit and, you know, I shouldn't say try to enjoy myself a little bit more is what I'm trying to say.
Enjoying yourself at the racetrack seems to be, like you said, a priority for you as you've aged. And I know that this is still an open wound, but last year it seemed like you really did enjoy yourself more because of everything that happened. You know, you lost your mom the day before the first race of the season. And both you and your brother, Roger, were racing, you know, 24 hours later. And you were, I don't think you won the race, but maybe second. They almost had to pull you out of the car in victory lane. But it seemed like that really fueled you. And it seemed like you were having more fun last year for whatever reason. How tough was that to get through initially, and then how much fun was it at the end of the year when you?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, like you said, it's definitely an open wound. It's like, you know, we had talked about my mom was my mother and my father growing up. You know, you could not ask for anybody to be more supportive as far as racing as what my mom was. And, you know, it was basically, we figured that she had passed away actually was the same day as the opening race. And I wasn't going to go. I said, no way in hell am I going. And next thing I look out the window and, you know, a lot of my fellow racers, Brian Whittemore, Scott Duell, you know, everybody was down in the garage working on the race car, and they said, you're going. And, you know, I pretty much got dragged to the racetrack that day, but I think it was the best healing thing that you could ever do. You know, with the history of our family being there, and, you know, let's face it, that's what, you know, a lot of people didn't think it was correct that I should have been there. You know, being disrespectful, But I do not believe that it was disrespectful, because I know deep down my mom would want me, wanted me to be there.
Yeah, hell yeah.
And it definitely did put a hell of a fire under my butt to try to not try to prove something, but to, you know, to prove that I wasn't going to take this land down just because my mom was not there. It's still hard as hell. I mean, not gonna lie to you, getting out of the car and, you know, she's sat in the same spot for, you know, 56 years or whatever of Devil's Bowl, you know, and to look up there and not see her there, it's definitely, definitely one of the hardest things in the world for me. But another thing that really, you know, like, as you've brought up, is switching manufacturers and getting into this new Bicknell car, was like flicking a light switch for me. Obviously, when you're racing, you're not going good. You get frustrated. You don't even want to go to the racetrack, because deep down you have that feeling that I'm not even going to be have a chance of winning. And now when you got a good piece underneath you, it's, you know, it puts a lot of fun back in it when you can definitely be competitive.
Brian Whittemore, you had a wreck early in the year and had to borrow a car from him. And you won in that car, and it was like 20 years old.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Brian Whittemore, he's, you know, he's been around forever. And, ironically is, I went and got turned, and, he's the one that actually hit me.
Yeah.
and it actually literally destroyed that brand new car that was three races old. And, you know, it was instantly, Brian's like, I got my other car. He says, we're going to put it together. You're going to run it. And I'm like, you know, I didn't know what to say. You know, and while the new car was being built, went and drove Brian's 20-year-old car and won with it. And if it wasn't for him in that situation, we definitely would not have won the championship, because we, you know, still – we never missed a race. And after that, it's now I actually still drive that 20-year-old car on Friday nights at Claremont Speedway on the pavement. And it's still a very competitive car, believe it or not, for the age that's on it. And, you know, the misfit that it actually is for a car, we call it.
I really got a chuckle out of the fact that your 54th Devil's Bowl win came in car number 36.
that's actually a tough one for me to swallow. It's, you know, don't get me wrong. I would have loved to have it in the 54, but it was what made that kind of a special race is because you got, you know, who I was battling with, you know, Vince Quinville. Him and I have been rivalries forever. And for him and I to go back beating doors back and forth, you know, for that win, it, you know, it brought back a lot of memories, you know, of what, you know, Vince and I were, the way we used to be. You know, the track was tacky that night, and it was completely, you know, wide open racing, and there's Vince and I bouncing off one another and, you know, trying to get the win.
And that iconic picture of you, you know, pointing up at your parents, it was a great night.
Definitely.
Yeah. That said, you were not the guy to beat all season long, you know, right up until the end of the year. And you stole the championship from Justin Combs by 1 point. After being so close for so many years, over the span of 21 years, was it just relief, or, you know, how did that feel for you?
Going into the last race, I mean, anybody that knows anything about points, it's definitely you. It was almost an impossible feat to possibly do. And just going into the last race, it was just one of them, you know, hey, we had a great year considering the circumstances of destroying a car and having a lot of good finishes. We got a couple wins last year. And it was, you know, just going into the last race, it was, I couldn't lose second place, but, and it was like, we couldn't, you know, so the last race, it was just going in with basically with no expectations, because I couldn't mathematically lose second place in points. So I was going to have a minimum of second place points. And as you know, to try to get that, to be able to win the championship would almost have to be a miracle. And, you know, I mean, not gonna lie to you, after the end of the race, you know, I drove up from, I can't remember where I started, but I ended up, I think, sixth. I drove like a madman. It was green to white checkered. And, you know, threw the checkered flag, and I sit there and said to myself, I'm like, all right, we ended the year really good and solid second place points. And then I think it was you or whoever came across the receiver, and maybe it was Tony, and say, hang on a minute, it's really close. And I'm like, well, how can that even be possible?
Right. And, you don't just beat Justin Combs by 9 positions, right? Like,
exactly.
He's a great racer.
Yeah, I mean, Justin is a really good racer, and he was consistent all year. And it was just like, you know, it was just in my mind. It's like, you know, he started ahead of me. I got in front of him. And then it's like, you know, all he's got to do is just keep me in his sight. And he just had a terrible night. And it was just incredible to even imagine that I had beat him, you know, for that, you know, the championship.
Has it even sunk in yet, really?
Yes and no. It started to sink. It sinks in when you start seeing, you know, I think it really sunk in big time at the race and banquet. That's when it really hit home. And then for my mom and my dad to be inducted into, well, John Bruno Award for their dedication over the years. That really hit home. And then as far as, you know, like me winning the other night, all of a sudden, you know, you start seeing defending track champion, you know, on whatever article there is, you know, that's it really makes me stand proud, and, you know, that I was actually able to do that. And, you know, going to the track, it makes me proud knowing that I was, you know, last year champion, and, you know, I'm going to give it a hell of a run again this year to try to get that championship again.
Opening night was special for you guys in a different way as well. Cause your brother Roger finally got his first win. That was a pretty great moment.
Yeah. I mean, you know, who would ever think somebody that's 65 years old decides that wants to become a race car driver. You know, he raced my dad's car back in the 70s. My dad had gotten hurt on the dairy farm. He got attacked by a bull. And my brother Roger at that time, you know, even though my father was out for them couple races, his car was still there. And my brother Roger, from what I remember, would go out and run the warm-ups and take like one lap in a heat and one lap in a feature just to have the car there. But he never really ever really raced. And then, you know, he got into the little mini sprints, and he did a lot of homework this winter. And, you know, he was never very mechanically inclined on a lot of things. And I think it was the best thing for him, excuse me, that, you know, he was able to disassemble the whole entire car, put it all back together, and, you know, to see him get a win, his first win ever. And then, you know, he came up to me before I went out, and he said, wouldn't it be awesome if we were both to pull a win off? That'd be a hell of a Mother's Day present, you know, for mom, you know, being the 1 year anniversary, and to be able for me to pull off the win also. It was pretty remarkable for our family to both of us get a win on the same night.
Are you guys close? You're quite a bit different in age. You know,
quite a bit. Yeah. We're hugely different. And, I shouldn't say huge. We're roughly 16 years apart between me and my oldest brother. You know, we're quite a bit. Roger, when I first got back into racing after 2010, my brother Roger was definitely a huge supporter of me getting back into the race. And he actually helped me get my, you know, me starting to get, get another car. We bought a car from Eddie Marshall, and he was definitely a huge part of me getting back into the racing again. Definitely.
So where do you go from here? I mean, obviously you're not slowing down.
Like I said, we have gotten a new car. We're just waiting for a motor for it. We went and got another new Bicknell car. And I know this year we're going to do some, hopefully do some special races. And we're going to go to Oswego this year, we're hoping. And, you know, we're going to, you know, hopefully try to spread our wings a little bit this year as far as being able to do some of the dirt series races and stuff like that. You know, but obviously our main key is definitely Devil's Bowl. No question about it.
Barry Tile, quick hitters. Then we'll let you go. First up, what driver did you learn the most from by watching them race while you were in the car?
Oh boy, you got a good question there. Honestly, when I first got the modifieds, Dave Camara was definitely one that I had, you know, learned a lot from to watch, and not only watch, to watch on the track, to follow him. He was definitely a one. And another one was too, is Jack Johnson. I raced against him for quite a few years, Albany, Saratoga, before he became sick. I learned a lot from a lot of the, you know, the veterans like that at that point in time. You know, Bob Savoy, all of them. You know, one driver that I really could pick out and say, I'm not really sure, to be honest with you.
What's the dumbest thing you ever did in a race car?
Probably, actually, you go back to back in the asphalt days when we were racing asphalt, and I retaliated on Vince after the checkered flag. And that's probably the dumbest thing I've ever done in a race car. It's, you know, your anger gets the best of you. And, you know, when you're sitting there struggling, it's just, you know, just like we talked about, when you're sitting there struggling, and you can only take so much. And, you know, not going to lie, after a race, after a checkered flag, I went and just piled into Vince, and I wished I had never done that, because that haunted me for several years, doing an idiotic move like that. And if I could take it back, I'd do it in a heartbeat. Huh. Just seems like that me and the Quinville thing just seems to is always there, you know, but we're good.
Well, last question is, what one person do you always want to finish one spot ahead of? Doesn't matter if it's 22nd and 23rd or 1st and 2nd. Who's the one person you want to finish one spot behind you?
Well, it all depends on the year and who is the year and who is at the track. You know, it's like last year, obviously, was Dimitri Estrellas. I mean, you always wanted to finish ahead of him, and you always wanted him behind you. This year, coming into it, it's going to be pretty tough down here. You know, with Todd Stone coming back and Justin being very strong, you know, if I was to pick two guys this year, it would probably definitely be Todd and Justin, because, you know, they're a class act, and they put a lot of heart and soul into this racing, and they're good friends of mine. We laugh and joke around all the time, but, you know, I think to finish ahead of them, every night this year, that'd be a win for me.
Okay, man. Well, good luck this year. Send me a bill for my toilet that you fixed, because you haven't done that yet.
Before we go on this whole thing, I just I need to just throw in there a couple things. It's as far as me last year getting the momentum and the equipment underneath me last year and this year, there's one guy, Steve LaRose, from Holland Pump. He took me under his wing, and without that man, honestly, I don't think I'd even be racing right now. With obviously the price of things, Steve has just been complete wide open arms. And, you know, he's like, what we need or what we need to compete. And that man has just not only become my supporter, my number one supporter as far as, you know, knowing what we have. He's become a very close friend of mine, and I really look up to the man. He, you know, gives me a lot of strong advice as far as not just thing, you know, not as far as the race cars, as far as, you know, has kind of guided me in a lot of good directions as far as, you know, being in business, because he's been in business for years. He's just an overall great guy. And, you know, without him and his support, this could never be possible what I'm doing right now.
Was he into racing before last year?
No, never.
Unbelievable.
That I know of. Actually, well, his dad was into drag boat racing. And they were into that. His father did that for years. And actually, Steve, from what I've gotten from Steve, is that him and his children, they're into some horse racing. And, you know, like I said, Holbert Supply has been with me for quite a few years now, but Steve LaRose purchased Holbert Supply. Holbert Supply still has a couple stores that he keeps under the name Holbert. But, you know, Steve has just been a huge inspiration for me and has just given me the, you know, has definitely put equipment underneath me to fulfill, you know, the championship. Because last year, we went and destroyed the car, and it was just a matter of no time, and he had another car right underneath me. And then this year, you know, we got another new car, and we're definitely going to, you know, hit some shows. And like I said, without that man, none of this would even be possible.
Well, best of luck to you, and give it hell down there at Devil's Bowl.
Definitely. And I thank you guys very much for having me on the show, and you'll have to drag Tom down some night to the Devil's Bowl. And
that's what I've been saying.
What is he, just a dirt, was he one of these guys that don't like to get his hands dirty and just stay on the pavement? Or?
I got three kids, five and under. That's the big big drawback for this guy.
Okay, well, Justin's been dragging his kids to the races even when they were that age.
Yeah, I got one. He's got three.
One is different than three. Yeah. But I will, I wouldn't mind getting down there, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Get yourself a babysitter and come down some night and I think you'd enjoy it.
I look forward to it. Thanks again to Tim for giving us so much of his time. We definitely appreciate it. And, you know, another good show, and we say that every week, but I thought especially kind of the second half of our conversation really got interesting and headed in some different directions, and talking about, you know, family and losing family and his personal health. And
yeah, there was some deep stuff in there. And I also really enjoyed learning a little bit more about the tractor pulling stuff. I will admit I know nothing about it other than it's loud and dirty and I enjoy it when I'm there, but I don't seek it out, you know? And he has got it bad. He is addicted to it. And the machine he's got is something. But what a completely different world than the roundy round stuff, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's not many similarities, and you even heard him say it in the interview. He doesn't even see very many similarities between that and drag racing, which from a layman looking from the outside would say, oh, it's, you know, practically the same. It's its own world, that's for sure.
Very interesting stuff, yeah. So we'll work a little bit harder on lining something up for like Sunday or Monday, okay?
Yeah.
But by we, I mean I will work harder for you, Tom, this week.
Who knows? You listening, you could be listening on your iPod for, I don't know, for those who still have an iPod. I don't know why I said iPod.
2008?
Those listening on your phone, in your car, Justin may be calling you next. So don't screen your calls.
Right. But I'm going to call you on like Sunday.
Make sure you're following us on all the socials one more time. It's Uncommon Deeds on Twitter and Facebook. Uncommon Deeds Podcast on the Instagram.
The Instagram, yeah.
If you are interested in becoming part of the Uncommon Media family, whether by sponsoring the Uncommon Deeds podcast, maybe the Crunch Bunch podcast tickles your fancy, or maybe you have a media idea or podcast idea that you think we can help you with, you can send us an email, uncommonmediavt@gmail.com.
Gmail.
Other than that, you know, rate, subscribe, do all those things that will help us with algorithms and other words that no one really knows what they mean.
I was just going to say, I don't know what an algorithm is. I use the word as if I do know, but it's nope.
It's when Al starts dancing. Get it? Algorithm. When Al starts dancing.
Have I made my algorithms joke?
I have now.
No, it's something about a band of math teachers who sing about vice presidents.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up today's podcast.
The Al Gore rhythms. Get it?
Thank you for tuning
in. Come on, the algorithms.
We'll be back next week. You've been listening to the Uncommon Deeds podcast, a production of Uncommon Media. Algorithm.